Call State Affairs Committee. Call State Affairs Committee to order at 08:43. On the 14th day of March 1990, let the records show. Representative Hanley, Representative Finkelstein, Representative Jawacki, Representative Menard, and Chair Representative Boucher are present. We've got one piece of legislation, and I'd like to take the opportunity to welcome Colonel Bo Grice, who we will be hearing from later as he testifies on Resolution HJR 86, which will be before us. We carried over from yesterday, at the request of some of the committee members, SCR 36, Conference on Aging, and there was a question on the budget there. And you have those numbers in front of you, dated 8/13. Is there someone here representing the commission? Why don't you come on up here in case there's any further questions?
We'll let you jump right in there.
Well, I think Representative Finkelstein's coming back to you here. I'll try not to take a seat. Are we on teleconference, Chair?
No, we're not on for this.
Good morning. I'm Connie Seidel, the Executive Director for the Older Alaskans Commission, and we have been working in support of this resolution in the Senate and in the House. One of the things I need to make clear to you is that what we have done, we have the figures from the last time there was a last conference on aging in 1981. And the actual budget spent at that time, it was before the Older Alaskans Commission existed, it was the Governor's Advisory Council on Aging. They spent $120,000 on the actual expenses of the conference, and they devoted a full-time professional and a secretary to supporting the seniors throughout the state during the year that led up to the conference, because the conference is a culmination of local forums on aging, local communities picking delegates and sending issues and having it all culminate in this one conference on aging in the state, which then picks delegates to go to the national conference in the fall of 1991. So the budget that we have presented to you of $199,000, which was trimmed $50,000 by the Senate, is almost exactly the same as what was spent in 1981 without any allowance for inflation and other factors. At that time, we didn't ask for special funding for the staff, but the staff ratio has changed quite a bit in the last 5 years. From 27 staff, we now have 14 staff. And we can't carry a special project like this without the staff. And what we're planning here, there was a question I understand yesterday, I wasn't able to be here, I apologize, about the staffing budget, is that we had planned to lay off a professional project coordinator based in Anchorage, who is in fact the person who ran last year's conference. We would either put that person on for the rest of the year so he could work on the conference, or we would hire someone new as this money extends. But we do expect it will take a 10 to 11 a month commitment by an employee. The bill itself calls for us, not just the Older Alaskans Commission, to plan this conference single-handedly, but to appoint a statewide planning committee that represents urban seniors, rural seniors, elders groups, retired employees groups, anyone interested in aging. We anticipate probably 18 to 20 people, and they will lay out the plans for the conference. So this budget is a guideline for them, but it is not an absolute commitment to each thing that will be happening as the conference comes together. We have made some tentative, you know, talks and gotten budgets from University of Alaska Fairbanks for how much they'll charge for the physical putting on of the conference at their conference center and leasing us the dorms and the meal service. We have put money in to try to keep the cost reasonable. In the contractual cost on the second page, you see that we do some underwriting of the meals and the rooms so that a delegate can come for a couple hundred dollars plus expenses for a week. And that's a great concern, that we don't want seniors shut out because they want to come from their town, they're the selected delegate, but maybe their village can't raise the money to send them. We're trying to keep the cost reasonable. So a fair amount of the money is earmarked for some slight subsidy, not free. It'll still cost something. We'll ask local communities to raise the money to send their delegates, but we have tried to think of this in advance. The seniors in the state, Older Persons Action Group, the AARP statewide legislative chapter, and AARP does represent about 33,000 people in the state, and the Older Alaskans Commission itself are all very keenly interested in. We've heard nothing but support all over the state, but seniors feel they'd like to see this event happen. They want a large-scale, professional-level conference, and so what we're asking for, and I'll be glad to entertain questions, not run on, is just a one-time budget increment to handle this conference at a good professional level, and then, like the project employee who's in here, will then go off the payroll. And so will the half-time clerk. And the rest expenses will not be repeated in the next budget.
Okay. Does that answer your questions regarding the budget, Representative Zawacki?
I had a question.
All right.
Representative McLean, I think.
And Representative
Wisconsin. Is Eileen here this morning?
She's on her way, though.
Beg pardon?
She's on her way.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I also spoke to some people on the commission since the last meeting, and that and this budget are both pretty helpful.
All right. Yes. Chair, I'll entertain a motion to move it on to the next committee of referral.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Any objection? Pat now wants to stay. We met Colonel Bogrice. He's going to be testifying.
I'm not there yet.
I'll talk about the chairman.
I'll let the record show that we've been joined this morning. I appreciate it very much by the chairman of Senate State Affairs, Senator Pat Porchot, and Colonel Bryce will be testifying on the next piece of legislation, which indeed is probably one of the more interesting pieces of legislation we've had before the committee.
More interesting than my bill?
We have to.
You want a consensus?
I want to know if we have to declare.
I'm not going to answer that.
The chairman and I.
All right.
Thank you, committee.
I said
you're
that.
Getting smart with me, Alexander.
Two of us. I was including myself. I thought
yeah,
maybe
you,
we should.
You? I have a conflict on the last bill. I think people 65 and over should be out working. I got news for them. I mean, I think they should work till they run out of runway. I told them to put my Social Security check on hold. I'd see them when I'm 70, and I'll probably go back and tell them, hey, can I double my money and go for 75?
Probably won't be anything left, Mr.
Chairman. All right.
Reconsider that.
Yeah. And we have committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 86, which we worked on with Representative Foster at his request as before us. Have you? Thank you, Ann. We have committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 86, which we worked on with Representative Foster. Have you had an opportunity to see the draft of the committee substitute, Representative Foster?
Yes, sir, I have.
It
looks real good.
Okay, fine. So we can get on and give Colonel Grice the opportunity to testify on this legislation. I accept a motion for the acceptance of committee substitute.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Any objection? All right. Representative Foster, you are the sponsor of the legislation. Would you care to testify, sir?
Yes, sir, very briefly. Since we do have Colonel Wrights here, I'm going to let him do all the talking if it meets with the pleasure of the committee. The bill is self-explanatory. You have the folder in front of you. I'd like to thank two people that came down from Anchorage, spent a lot of their own time and personal expense coming down here, Sherman Reynolds and Rick Schneider, both longtime residents of Anchorage. And I really want to acknowledge them being here today. And I'm going to go ahead and just let the Colonel explain the rationale behind the bill.
I think, Richard, too, I mean, for the service that the Colonel has given to his country, I think it's fitting that maybe you touch, you being a Vietnam veteran yourself, and of course you were both kids when I was a WWE veteran. I guess you never got to finish up what we didn't get to finish up, which I'm not sure if anybody will ever get to finish up. But I think that the service that this man has given to his country, I think I'd like to have that included here on the record if you want to.
Yes, sir, I'm sure I'm going to forget something, but it's a great honor for me to introduce Colonel Drake. He's the most heavily decorated Special Forces veteran of the Vietnam War, with over 60 decorations, including 3 Silver Stars, 8 Bronze Stars with V Valor devices, 2 Purple Hearts. He commanded certain forces of the Special Forces in Vietnam, and he spent several tours there. I think he could probably touch on them better than I can. And he's done a lot of work since the Vietnam War trying to repatriate or find POWs that are ostensibly still in Vietnam, American POWs and MIAs. And he's also heavily concerned and alarmed about the rise of drugs in the United States and the things that we can do as citizens here starting in Alaska to help stop this tide of drugs coming to our country. So maybe I could let him touch a little bit deeply on that. Thank you.
Colonel Rice, your name and address for the record, please, sir.
Yes, sir. My name is James Bo Greitz. I'm from 711 Yucca Street, Boulder City, Nevada, which is in the Center for Action. The zip code there, if we use that, is 89005. And I'm here to testify today at the request of Representative Foster and yourself with respect to this joint resolution 86, which has to do with winning a major campaign in the war on drugs. I'd like to first of all thank you, Mr. Chairman, and your counterpart here on the Senate, which I understand will probably have this joint resolution passed to you. We spoke to President of the Senate, Tim Kelly, yesterday, and like the Speaker of the House, he said he would allow it to go through one committee and then go to the floor within 2 weeks. So we appreciate the support we've had out of Alaska, especially out of these two gentlemen who have sponsored this resolution, and the good people from Eagle River and Anchorage, which we wouldn't have this resolution before you now if it weren't for their interest. So Alaska, besides being number one in size and up at the top of the list alphabetically, is doing something major in this war on drugs. I will give you some statistics that I've garnered up from the FBI. They can be verified if necessary through your own local offices. I've talked to a couple of people in Anchorage working for the FBI in the drug area. $7 out of misappropriated funds and or stolen goods is required for every dollar that is spent on drugs. You can imagine what would happen to our economy if we were to put that money back. We would all be a lot better off. I gathered up a document yesterday from that gave statistics that were calculated in 1988 by the Alaska Drug Enforcement Group that showed that 75% of your high school students in 1988 had the opportunity to use drugs. Of those 75% that had the opportunity, 60% partook of those drugs. Nancy Reagan, just before she left the White House in 88, said that 90% of the graduating class in 1988 had at least experimented with illegal narcotics. While these figures were taken in 1986 and 1988 that were used by Nancy Reagan and by your own folks, I might remind you that the tonnage of opiates coming out of the Golden Triangle was 600 tons in 1986. It went up to 1,200 tons in 1988. But this year, the Drug Enforcement Administration of the United States estimates up to 3,000 tons of opiates will come out of the Golden Triangle. So we cannot keep up with these figures. They are probably much worse than indicated. President Bush, when he declared war on drugs September the 6th, isolated crack cocaine as the real villain. However, in reading the newspapers, the U.S. Senate put out a study almost the same time as a couple of days before, like the 4th of September, which said that America was being flooded with opium and heroin because crack cocaine's tendency to give you suicidal depression. The heroin is supposed to smooth out the landing there. So now much of the crack cocaine that people are becoming addicted to is being laced with heroin. With those figures, 600 tons in 86 to 3,000 tons in 1990, it's going somewhere, and much of it is coming in the United States. We have an opportunity to win a major campaign in this war on drugs. I have met personally on four occasions with General Khun Sa, who is the recognized drug overlord of the Golden Triangle, producing 90% of the world's heroin. Again, the opiates coming out of there this year will be 3,000 tons. That's up from 2,200 tons last year. It used to come out on muleback, but no longer. Now it comes out on 10-ton trucks, thanks to a new highway that was put put in from Thailand to Burma in 1987. Kuhn saw, and I wasn't there about drugs, I went at the request of the vice president, who at that time was George Bush. His office asked me in November of 1986 if I would go in search of prisoners of war in the Golden Triangle. I was the first U.S. agent, I was told by the National Security Council, to ever go into and come out alive from the Golden Triangle in these recent times. And while there, General Kuhn Saw, the overlord, gave me on videotape his response to the president, meaning both Reagan now and Bush, declarations of war on drugs. I presented, I think, each member of your committee with a copy of this videotape. If you haven't looked at it, you might. You can see Kuhn Saw for yourself. Basically, what he is saying and offering is the same thing that the U.S. Senate has come to a conclusion to. What Representative Rangel in his recent visit to Thailand concluded, and what the president, I think, concluded in his summit meeting that he just terminated here recently. And that is that in order to win the war on drugs, it's not enough to go to the user. We must go to the source of the drugs. And Kuhn Saw, in 1987, made an offer. At that time, there were only 900 tons coming out of the Golden Triangle to stop every ounce. He wants the United States to help him legitimize his economy. For the record, I should explain, I think, so there isn't any confusion about it, exactly where he stands. The Shan territory is about one-third of the Burma landmass. It occupies the upper northeastern quadrant of Burma. It does, however, include about 80% of the potential economy. The best rubies in the world come from the Shan territory. Some of the best jade. It has almost limitless teak forest. It's all very high in altitude, much like Alaska, heavily forested, whereas a lot of Burma is not. In the southern parts, it's mainly lowland and is rice growing. The only crop, money crop, to come out of the Shan territory in the last 30 years has been opium, grown by poppies. March is the harvest month. As we're speaking right now, the little people there are slicing the bud of the poppy. It takes about 3 days. They'll scrape 2,000 of these, each farmer will. That's about what it takes to make 2 pounds of raw opium. And then that is their harvest for the whole year. By the end, by the time you conclude your session here, they will already have moved that raw opium down into heroin factories that are located in Thailand, some of them in Laos. And then by the end of May, we will start to see the 3,000 tons of opiates make its way into the free world. Kuhn Saw is considered to be the world's worst villain as far as illegal drugs. However, he is the recognized head of 8 million Shan people. In 1947, Great Britain gave independence to the Burma Union. It is made up of about five minorities in addition to the Burmese. The Shan, kind of like the state of Texas, held out and said that they would join the Burma Union, but only for 10 years. There was a Panlong agreement to that effect. After 10 years, the Shan territory would be given an autonomous state recognition as the Shan state. However, Ne Win took over. The first president of the Burma Union was a Shan. He was assassinated approximately a year into his tenure. The socialists took over, and of course, they forgot about the Panlong Agreement. And so since 1957 should have been their recognition as an autonomous state. They do not have a legitimate economy, and therefore they have not been recognized. Every year since 1957, the United Nations has warned the Burmese government that they must come to a political solution with the Shan government. They have a government in exile. It's called the Thai Revolutionary Council. Not spelled T-H-A-I like Thailand, but rather T-A-I, which means unified. There are 33 Shan, what do we call them, counties or principalities that are out there. But they are unified under the Thai Revolutionary Council, which is a government in exile in Thailand. The point is that if they had a legitimate economy, they could gain a legitimate nation state. They don't have a legitimate economy. Kuhn Saw, while he has been branded the worst criminal, and indeed he is the overlord of 90% of the world's opiates and heroin, is also George Washington on the flip side of the coin. He's 56 years old. He has expressed to me a strong desire to see his economy legitimized, leave as a legacy to his 8 million Shawn people a nation state, which they were promised. He's had to be ruthless. He's had to be strong in order to protect his country from the Burmese socialists. I think what we've seen in the anarchy in Burma is a clear example of why, if you were an anti-communist, which Khun Sa is, that you would have to be ruthless in protecting your borders. He has successfully done this. That's why he is the recognized overlord of the Golden Triangle. Simply, he's telling the U.S. State Department, and he wrote a letter to that effect. The letter is in the book, which I gave each member of the committee. The letter of the State Department says he offers to give 1 ton of refined, number 4, Asian heroin. It sells for $1 million a pound. Of course, he sells it for $300,000 a ton. The $1 million a pound comes from the distribution on the streets of the metropolitan areas of the United States. He said he would give that to the U.S. government as a show of good faith that he would completely eradicate opium from the Golden Triangle. We presented this letter to the U.S. State Department and received a no interest in return. The reason stated is because we have diplomatic relations with socialist Burma. And, of course, if we were to recognize or negotiate with Khun Sa, then it would go against the grain of our diplomatic relations with socialist Burma. Well, we have declared war on drugs officially again September the 6th via the United States President. Khun Sa, like Gorbachev, controls something that we want reduced. No matter what position Khun Sa occupies, in the case of Gorbachev, we wanted missiles reduced. We talked to him. He's a communist. I know he's also Time Magazine's Man of the Decade. But Khun Sa controls the opium and heroin. He says you don't have to declare war on him. In the statement that's in the videotape he made to you, he has asked for United States help in legitimizing his economy. There's three reasons we should give it to him. One is he's surrounded by communist countries. China is on his north. Laos is on his east. And socialist Burma, which is probably the strongest form of communism we've seen in the last 40 years, surrounds him, except for a small area in Thailand, which is the drug route. Secondly is because he wants to do something that is right. He wants to change a drug economy into a legitimate economy, and he has the resources to do so, but there's no electricity in Burma. There's only one highway now, and that's a heroin highway. He wants to have help in beginning to industrialize his nation so they can be exploited. He's offered our exploitation, even the Japanese. And third is because the State Department has done this on numerous occasions. Too bad John Fitzgerald Kennedy isn't still alive today and able to weigh in on this. It was his words that talked about no outpost too distant where freedom might come. There's no question that Khun Sa has made a proposal that we cannot lose that. What we have asked in the joint resolution is not for millions of dollars. We gave the Colombians $300 million this last year, and the first thing they did was buy jet fighters with it. Doesn't have much to do with the war on drugs. Khun Sa has said that he would carry out his part in the first year. As a reminder, it's in the packet that you also have, his written proposal signed and sealed. In the first year, he says he will completely eradicate one-third of the opium crop. It's not that we buy up the opium each year, which would be a recurring thing. He's a very clever person. He says that he will buy the poppies. Right now, the farmers came to him. They are coming now. It's the harvest month, and they will sell him their raw opium. If we would have last year taken him up, then this year they would be bringing him, instead of raw opium, poppies that they have uprooted. When you uproot the poppy, the nature of the plant is that you have to replant one if you want to have another this next March. And in this case, by buying up the poppies, he basically assures that the farmers are not growing opium. The farmers, however, will require a substitute. You can't just buy them 1 year and say, okay, now you're out on your own. Khun Sa understands that. He is asking for a United Nations and United States effort to help him find crop substitution. I'm not an agrarian myself, but I know the State Department does that very well. And Peace Corps, that's the whole foundation of the Peace Corps, to get out there and help these kind of developing nations. It's a proposition that we really can't say no to.
And in the resolution that we're asking you to pass, we aren't asking for a cent. We're asking that the United States Congress investigate Kunsaw's proposal, because I believe, having been there four different times, having recorded his comments, investigated it thoroughly, that one, he will do what he says, and secondly, with the way opium is going up every year, a one-third reduction is like a 100% reduction. And I believe that he will do it. We should test him for 1 year. If he doesn't measure up, then we go ahead and send F-111 bombers, like we did with Gaddafi, to give him a message. If he does measure up, though, then we're going to clean up 90% of the world's opiates. And that's moving in the direction the president wants to move. So we're urging you to get excited about this. I think it's appropriate that Alaska do this. We would use the Alaskan resolution as a model for the other states. I represent Center for Action. We have Centers for Action in every one of the 50 states. We will energize all of those Centers for Action using your example to go forward and to give a clear signal. Now, the executive branch has responsibility for this, and you know that, of course, Czar Bennett is the one tasked with this. And I understand that it's not easy for the legislative branch to take over when the executive branch has already accepted responsibility. But we're not winning the war on drugs. We're losing. The Senate has concluded that. The House of Representatives has concluded that. And so we must change what we're doing. Well, our great Constitution established a way to do that. And that is, when the executive branch is not carrying out to the satisfaction of the people their taskings, then the legislative branch brings them to task. So we're asking you to give a clear message that the U.S. Congress might investigate. I believe an honest, open investigation will reveal the merits. Kunsaw wrote me a letter this last 2 weeks ago that said that he is perfectly willing to send his staff representatives to appear before any meaningful hearing in Congress, that they might be examined and they might articulate clearly exactly what they will and what they won't do and what they want to do. I don't see how we can say no to this. While it does, of course, admonish the executive branch a little for not doing their job, what it does do is it puts government back in the hands of the people, which it was meant to be, and says, we want something done. The Congress could investigate. I think that we can win. It's not the war, but it's a major campaign in the war. And if it works, it might set a model for eliminating, without the billions and billions of dollars that go out in drug suppression funds that right now are not working. Not only Kunsaw, I might, in justice to him, I should give him credit for this. While I was there last, he said, you Americans don't show much common sense. You got to understand, Kunsaw didn't graduate from high school. He does not read nor write. I gave him a Fisher Space Pen when I was last there, but it's more of just a sign of dignity than it is a useful tool. He said, however, that you're talking about legalizing drugs. He said, that doesn't make sense. He said, the government should not be in a position to harm its people. You should not turn loose on the public with your seal of approval harmful drugs. He said, the simple way is, one, you stop the drugs at their source. Then, he said, the criminal element does not have the profit. And, he said, the user does not have the drug, and therefore they must seek rehabilitation. So he offered a fairly common sense plan to what we in the 50 states debate a lot over, whether or not the government should be in the business of legalizing drugs. I offer you this testimony. I'm certainly willing to answer your questions. I'm willing to back up everything I've said with the documents and the videotapes. We're just ready to make a stand and do something rather than talk about something in this war on drugs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Menard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Colonel, for the excellent testimony. My apologies to the committee. I do have a DNR subcommittee meeting, and they're going to work on a budget that I'm near and dear to, but you have my support. I am a co-sponsor on that, but I must leave. Okay. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No questions. I just want to make a statement that I have appreciated hearing the testimony from Colonel Greitz. I had the opportunity to meet him in Anchorage last fall, and very much impressed with his proposal. It certainly makes, I think it makes good sense, simply to ask the United States to look into this proposal. I too don't understand how we could lose in suggesting that we simply investigate and find out, and at least give this Kunsa the opportunity to show us if he is sincere, and that would be very simple. I think that we have everything to gain and very, very little that we'll be apt to lose by going forth with this resolution. And I really commend Representative Foster for introducing this. I was really pleased when I saw that this had been introduced, very much supportive of the resolution.
Thank you. Representative Wacky.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, you know, with the Colonel here and Representative Foster putting in this resolution, I think all of us should try any and every avenue possible that we can to eradicate drugs. As we are well aware in this state, as we sat last year in one committee when we had some students and youth in here and talked how easy it was walking out of this place and coming back in with drugs within 15 minutes, we have a serious problem out there. And regardless of proposals out there that may seem a little unusual for some people, I think we should try every avenue and come up with the successful solutions out there or combinations. So I appreciate the Colonel being here, and again, I appreciate Representative Foster putting in the resolution. I hope it is successful in a very short time.
I'm going to have the most questions. I haven't spent quite a bit of combat time in myself. I don't think there's any two people in this room that are probably better in more combat. So I watch the other person's eyes, and I see a lot more than his words. You said, I watched the tape last night, I watched it four times. This guy Kunsa makes me uneasy, you know. I saw you standing there eyeballing him. In fact, I was thinking this morning, if I had thought of it a week ago, I'd have said, can we hook him in to this teleconference? Because it'd be some questions I'd want to ask him. My experience level is I was watching people negotiate in Washington, D.C., and there's lots of my shipmates at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Well, those bastards were conning us, so I don't trust too many of them. But the ravage that this is doing to our country, the drugs, is far more than any Pearl Harbor ever happened to be. I mean, there are people that are dying in the streets and what have you. When the legislation first came, Representative Foster and Mr. Pignarberry, there was some inflammatory stuff in that I considered negative. And you know yourself, you've got to move in close. And if you make a lot of rattling noise. So what I did was, with staff, approach this thing positive. Have you seen the change from the original to this here?
I've seen what the Representative Boston.
Okay. Does this start the job for you?
Well, I don't think there's any question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
This is certainly a move in the right
direction. All right. Well, we've had a lot of politics as to what this thing does and what it doesn't do. I wanted to start it out on a positive. In other words, before it kind of bad wrapped the State Department, I don't think that's going to get us in there, because you obviously, we've included documentation in here about, let's say, the differences of opinion. And in some cases, the amazing things that happen in CIA. What's going on there now is a lot going on that this country don't know about. And I recognize it, covert operations, what have you, but I don't care what happens if people in the name of freeing other people are enslaving other people through drugs, i.e. The whole Contra operation. You know, it makes me want to puke. I think the key thing is, do you really believe this guy? You sure you aren't con? Now, he's a master at PR. I mean, he gets 20-20 in there and the other people. What makes you think this guy's going to keep his word?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate the way you worded this, because you're not talking about the problem. You're talking about a solution. Mm-hmm. And we can all talk about problems until we're blue in the face and it doesn't make a change. So the approach you've taken is a solution. It's a positive move, and it's not dealing with the problem. So I appreciate that. As far as Kunsa goes, I go on skin feelings also. We first came in there, Again, it was for prisoners of war. I had a letter from the White House. The CIA has a seven-digit figure on his head for assassination, and no one's been able to collect. There is no number two. He is the overlord. He fought a war in 67 that he won. It's called the Opium Wars, and he's emerged as the overlord of that area. That's why he has that title. He had to have some special interest in order to allow us to come in. I speak, read, and write Chinese. I went through a Chinese network that was set up by the CIA in 1979 and 1980 that I hadn't energized before 1986. So when I got into his camp, I didn't go there for drugs. And when finally I asked him about him, he was very ready just to give me a message for President Reagan. And I have been there now four times since 86. In the visits I've made, I sense that he does want to leave a legacy of freedom to his people. In the offer he makes, there's really not a way that we can lose that I see it. Now, again, I'm not a rocket scientist when it comes to con games. I'm a soldier, and we have a tendency to believe people until we're proven wrong, but I'm also an intelligence officer, and so I'm supposed to be able to see behind the veils of purpose. I think that with what he has said, that he would allow investigators, he wants our help. He's saying, you send me your Peace Corps. I'll guarantee their safety. Very brave thing for him to say, because a lot of the Thai officials and Burmese officials, of course, are making money off of the opium crops. It doesn't go, there's no runways in the Golden Triangle. It goes by truck to Mae Hong Song. It's loaded aboard official aircraft, and it's flown out of there. So the money is being made. $300,000 a ton is what he sells it for. $1 million a pound once it hits the streets of New York and Seattle. By his offer to open his gates for investigation, by his very courageous offer to say in the first year, you will see a 30% reduction in opiates and heroin. Those are very brave claims. I don't see how we can't just say, all right. I know, for example, in Thailand, they have been trying, through the U.S. State Department, for decades to have a crop substitution plan go into the Golden Triangle. But the politicians wouldn't permit it, and we didn't really push it. And it was never thought to work because it was figured that Khun Sa and his 15,000-man Shan army would fight against it. But if he's opening his gates and saying, you send your investigators, as long as they don't try to kill me, he said, they're welcome to come in. We'll ensure their safety. We need your help, he says. And you can investigate, you can monitor, you can do whatever you want. I think he's making an honest plea. If you would have looked at George Washington and Madison and Jefferson back when we became a nation, and you would have been talking before the King of England, they wouldn't have had glowing words for those revolutionaries. And it was just a minority that made that strong stand. Most of the people were ready just to acquiesce. I think we have to test him. And what we're asking for here is just an investigation. Let those 435 people in those august bodies in Washington, D.C. that we elect make the final calls. But if we don't test him, I think that we have shut the door on an invitation that could, in quick order, working at the grassroots, start to pair off this. The worst threat America's ever faced is drugs. I don't think it's communist, do you?
No.
I don't even think it was fascist. I think drugs has come down to our worst enemy.
You got it.
So if we can get the man, it'd be like having Tojo on our side. If he's willing to work from the inside to help us, I say let's let him. What can we lose, literally, at this point?
Just one other question. We have someone in Anchorage, and I'm going to be sure and let you testify. In the folder, I put all the information that we were able to get. We wrote for Senator Murkowski or what have you. And if you get through reading that, you don't know which side to believe. I mean, we got a United States Senator that says, well, you know, we're not too sure about this guy, and we're not too sure about this. Tell me about that. What's your reaction? I read what your response. In fact, it was about 3 o'clock last night. I finished your book. So there's one thing I determined. If you're pushing this hard, you ought to be listened to.
Well, I got shot in the back of the head in Vietnam, Mr. Chairman, and the bullet bounced off. It's testimony that I am hard-headed. I was assigned the prisoner of war mission in 1979. I didn't believe there were prisoners of war then, but I decided if enough people in the intelligence community thought there were, that I would give it my best shot. When I found out there were, then there was no way that they could turn off the bubble machine. I stuck steadfast to what we knew to be true.
What do you mean by the bubble machine?
Well, Lawrence Welk, I used to watch those things, and you'd see the bubbles go up, and often we used to talk about what happened if the bubble machine ever got stuck.
Okay.
And you couldn't turn it off. Well, once I knew what the truth is, then there's no way that I'm going to give up on things that are right. That man up there, JFK, said that the basic ethic and moral is courage in your convictions when you believe yourself to be right. There are prisoners of war, and so we haven't given up on them. As a result, President Reagan completely changed the White House policy from the fact that there are no prisoners to the fact that we must assume that there are. It's because of veterans and people like myself who, I've been there, I haven't seen the movie, or read something, I've been on the ground, and so I make those reports. In the drug business, it's the same way. As you mentioned, we have seen an uncovering of skullduggery, which to us now, it's hindsight, doesn't look good. The U.S. Senate concluded that yes, there was collusion on the part of U.S. government agencies and drug trafficking with respect to the Contras. The same thing has been concluded with respect to Southeast Asia and those war games there. There's no question that, unfortunately, elements within the executive branch has seen fit to acquiesce to or promote or allow or be engaged in drug trafficking to promote covert operations that the U.S. Congress didn't approve of. U.S. Congress said we couldn't go into Laos, but we did, and there are 308 Americans that were left there as a result of that that haven't come home. When this thing first came down, it was, again, I'm not a politician. It was head-to-head. I just call the shots exactly the way I see them. To me, there was a problem with prisoners and a problem with this drugs, and the response I was getting out of Washington, D.C. Wasn't satisfactory. Quote, it was no interest. And I knew that wasn't true. There has to be interest, because President Reagan declared war on drugs, and Vice President Bush was the leader of that war on drugs. So it wasn't no interest. So something else was there. When Senator Murkowski inquired, which I'm sure that he did, of the State Department, what's going on, that's the normal methodology up there, they gave him an unsigned, undated National Security Council appraisal, which we've proven to be absolutely false. No one in the NSC signed it. No one dated it. At the time that was made, they had told me, very frankly, to either erase and forget, or that they would bring hostile witnesses and aggravated charges against me. A special agent, Farquhar, and I'll make available to you that report if you don't already have it, from the U.S. State Department in April of 1989, in a sworn statement before the Los Angeles Police Department, said that as the caveat to the beginning, he says, let me state for the record that before we get into this, that Bo Greitz and has been confirmed to have been an agent of ISA, the Intelligence Support Activity, which is an arm of the National Security Council. It was illegal because the U.S. Congress didn't know about it. But that was a dent in the turret that President Reagan took back in 1984 when it was revealed that Bo Greitz has been confirmed to have been an agent of the ISA, that his mission and the missions of ISA are classified. So even in 1989, the special agent from the U.S. State Department are admitting the fact that we are a part of the intelligence activity, that our missions were classified. It runs right in the face of that NSC unsigned, undated letter. But at the time that was written, it was a contest. I was angry because it looked like we were having government cover-up of the most heinous crime I can imagine, that is poisoning of America with drugs. And I was going for the juggler, which is the only approach I know to make. And the government was doing, those in government that had, were threatened, I think, were doing what they thought they needed to in order to protect their interests. And that was to try and discredit me initially. But again, you have my response. You have that NSC letter. You've got, I think I've included as part of the record, Scott Farquhar, the U.S. State Department special agent, report in there. And so you can make your own conclusions. Again, I stand and raise my hand to swear, and swear before God, angels, and witnesses that everything that I have said is the record to make that same oath, because I don't think they will.
just wanted to make sure that verbally you had the chance to say it. Everybody's got it in his pocket, you know, and we like to treat our guests good.
But Senator Murkowski, he's just passing on what he's been given, and it would be a lot easier for him if we didn't have this thorn in his side, because now he will have to be one to go forward and say, oh, gosh, we don't need to muddy the water of the executive branch, but we got a problem here. And I know it's more work for him, and he's got his menu already full. But this is really important.
We've got a person in Anchorage wanting to stay here. I want you to think of what you want to tell us in your last 30 seconds. Okay? Anchorage, why don't we go ahead and testify?
My name is Dick Lochner. I'm a retired Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army, and I've been an Alaskan resident for 17 years. For the record, I live in Eagle River, 10593 Sunbow Drive. I've prepared a statement to save valuable for committee time, but before I get into my statement, Mr. Chairman, I heard you referring to some changes, and it sounded up here as though the resolution has been changed. What I have in front of me at the very top says introduced 21290, referred state affairs 6-2241A. Is that the same? We're looking at the same thing?
It's dated 3990. If you've got a copy. 3990. That's a committee substitute. And we're going to fax it up to the LAL for you.
We do not have that if you'd fax one to Anchorage.
The copy's on the way to you right now.
Okay. I'm the past president of the Association of the United States Army Alaska Chapter, past chairman of the Alaska Army Retirees Council, and former elected officer of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and a life member of the Disabled American Veterans. I'm active in these organizations and several others. I have 7 children and 11 grandchildren. And I'm very concerned about the drug problem in the United States, and I'm active within my organizations to take positive action to reduce the drug problem in our country. We have 2% of the world population and consume 60% of the world's drugs. It's time to stop talking and to do something. I'm active in the Veterans of Foreign Wars in promoting the implementation of the CUNSA proposal, or have our elected officials follow up on some variation of the proposal. Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 9785 at our last meeting gave tacit approval for the resolution which is now before you, at least before me. We'll get the other one on the facts. The motion to approve the resolution was tabled pending changing of the wording in the paragraph that reads, be it resolved, the Alaska State Legislature, etc. We're changing that to, be it resolved, the Department of Alaska of the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States at the 45th Annual Convention. I personally guarantee that this resolution will pass unanimously tonight at our regular meeting. Our legislature has the opportunity to be a leader in the nation in doing something positive in this drug war and circumventing the political rhetoric of the Washington bureaucrats. We in the VFW are endeavoring to support that opportunity for our great state to take the lead. As we speak, one of our most respected members is at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Washington Conference lobbying for this resolution. When our resolution is passed tonight, it will go to the Department Convention in June and be passed on to the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars this summer. Our member who is presently lobbying for the passage of this resolution also the chairman of the National Resolutions Committee in Washington and has assured me that the resolution will be adopted by the National Veterans of Foreign Wars. We anxiously await the passage of the resolution by our Alaska legislature. As soon as our legislature passes the resolution, we intend to amend our resolution to read, just before where it says in the resolution, be it resolved, we want to add, whereas this resolution entitled HJR 86 has been endorsed by the 16th Legislature, second session by the legislature for the state of Alaska, now therefore, etc. Gentlemen, I urge you to take the lead and let it be known that we demand action. I'm open to any questions and request any positive information I can pass on tonight at our VFW meeting. I might add that there was one other slight change in the very first paragraph where the HDR 86 reads, whereas abuse of drugs is a high priority shared by the state and federal government, our resolution reads, whereas trafficking and abuse of drugs is a high priority shared by all concerned citizens. Other than that, our resolution is identical to yours.
Thank you, sir. We got two more pieces of legislation what I'd like to do is move it on to the next committee. That's the way it gets to the floor, and if there's any changes, they can be made down the road or what have you. You got 30 seconds.
Chairman, I want to
now you
thank,
come all the way from Nevada, and I want you talking from your guts, how you feel about this thing.
Well, if I were to talk from my guts how I feel about it, only you and I would probably be able to understand my language, since paratroopers and sailors probably share the same vernacular. But I know you can't put that in the record. I am disgusted, as you are, to see America, the greatest nation on the face of the earth, liberally being brought to its knees by a destructive drug, which doesn't seem to be stoppable. At least it hasn't been stopped in 10 years of declaring war on it. I, again, didn't read it in the book, didn't see the movie. I went to Burma. I wasn't didn't choose to. I was chosen. And I brought back what I believe to be a firm offer that needs to be looked at. If there are bureaucrats within any of the departments of the executive, legislative, or judicial branch that are threatened, I don't care about them. I care more about my country and about its people. I raised my hand and I swore to defend this nation against enemies foreign and domestic. I have fought against enemies foreign as you have. And now it's time to turn our interest inward, even if it means taking a last hill, Capitol Hill, not by storm, but by ballot if necessary, then I'm prepared to do so. There's nothing more important than defending our nation against its greatest enemy right now, and that's drugs. We have an opportunity to win a major campaign, not just a battle, a major campaign. And if it happens to uncover rats that are in the bureaucracy, then let them be washed away so we can have clean government for a change as we approach the 1992 elections. I salute you. I salute all of those veterans and people of Alaska who have chosen to make a firm stand and to do something other than just talk about winning this war on drugs. God bless you.
Thank you, sir. Chair, I'll accept the motion to move it out of committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I make a motion to move out the committee substitute for House Rep. Resolution 86.
Any objection? So moved.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Members of the committee, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Well, sir, good luck to you.
Good luck to you. You're the one that needs it.
I don't know. Red in October, that's a pretty strong campaign slogan.
Well, you move quietly and get as close as you can to the target.
Well, you wouldn't want me as your point man. I just bust right straight ahead. It's a major failure.
If you get hit in the head and with bullets, and you're still here.
That's it, sir. Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Give my best to that young FBI couple.
Thank you. I will.
You know, Tom Fink could use him as his point man. That's sort of Tom's strategy.
Does the bullets bounce off your head?
Well, just sort of bounce on through it, you know, like let nothing get through.
We have that caucus. I don't know if we...
Yeah.
All right, well... Okay, that's taken care of. We got eligibility for permanent fund dividends. Representative Finkelstein.
Mr. Chairman, how much time we got left today?
We got this about 20 minutes.
We had one out-of-state witness, out-of-town witness, Dana Tindall, for the next meeting. I was wondering if... On the telecommunications one?
All right, okay. I want to carry it over so she has to stay here. I mean, we don't
she
agree with each other,
anyway.
She's one of my favorite people.
I'm planning to leave this evening, but if you need to.
Maybe we can
take her testimony?
Yeah, maybe just.
Yeah, I was teasing.
Can we just
take her testimony? Very thoughtful of you. Well, where is Representative Lehman? He's on. You people in the minority are always griping because of the fact that none of your bills are heard, and I don't even see him here.
They told him it was the last bill.
He what? Hey, if that was his priority, he should be sitting out here in the bleachers.
Would you like me to wait for...
No, not, you don't have to wait. You go right ahead and testify. I wouldn't keep you waiting. You're still fighting the battle, aren't you?
Still fighting the battle.
Okay, all right.
For the record, my name is Dana Kendall. Good morning to the members of the committee and Mr. Chair. I'm here today to talk to you about the subject I always like to talk about, and that is in-state long-distance toll competition. And what I have to say is basically competition works. And we've just been witness to some recent events by Alaskan that proves once again competition works. And on February 28th of last month, Alaskan came into the APUC and proposed to reduce its rates by $11.4 million. And I'd like to go over the sequence of events on that proposed rate reduction. RCA Alaska bought the long-distance telephone system from the military in 1969. From 1969 until about June 1989, Alaskan never came in once and initiated a voluntary rate decrease. In June of 1989, GCI filed with the Lieutenant Governor's Office an initiative for to be authorized for circulation. 5 days later, Alaskan lowered their rates by $10.3 million. In December of 1989, GCI amended its application with the Alaska Public Utilities Commission with a proposal to serve the entire state of Alaska within 5 years of getting authority to provide intrastate service. In February, Alaskan dropped its rate, or is proposing to drop its rates, by $11.4 million in addition to the earlier $10.3 million. I think you can take a couple of things from that. One, it's clear competition works. Not only is it clear that competition works, it's clear that the threat of competition works. And it is clear that Alaskan believes competition works. Alaskan, by its actions, has validated GCI's proposal to serve the entire state of Alaska. They're preparing for competition. There's some questions that can come out of this, too. In Alaskan's filing before the PUC, it showed that in 1989, they earned a 35% rate of return. They're only authorized to earn an 11.4% rate of return. In 1988, Alaskan earned almost a 30% rate of return. The question that's obvious to everyone is, where is the APUC? Where have they been? Why are they allowing Alaskan to earn a 35% rate of return? Does regulation work? No. Clearly no. The only thing that works to bring down rates in Alaska is competition. What is clear from this series of events is that the APUC, unwittingly or not, has been aiding Alaskan in earning monopoly profits. Alaskan lowered its rates in June 1989 by $10.3 million 1 month after it concluded a rate design and rate revenue requirement case before the APUC. That rate case was started in 1983. Again, it was concluded in 1989. 1 month later, Alaskan proposes to lower its rate by $10.3 million. Where is the APUC? Clearly not watching Alaskan's rate of return. The other thing, Representative Lehman's bill that you have before you today that's co-sponsored by Representative Hanley would put in-state competition in place immediately. It wouldn't put it back in front of the APUC. It's clear that the APUC has not been doing its job on this particular subject and has been allowing rate of returns in excess of 11% and should not have the obligation to decide whether there should be competition. Let me give you a little bit of the history of GCI's attempt to bring competition to the state of Alaska before the APUC. In 1983, when the Federal Communications Commission authorized competition, the APUC decided that they would take a look at it. And they put out the question, should Alaska have competition in in-state long-distance telephone services? GCI replied, many of the local telephone companies replied, and Alaskan replied. We had hearings. We had reply comments. We had more hearings. GCI proposed a set of regulations. In 1986, the APUC closed that docket with no action. Their stated reason in an open meeting for closing that docket was that they didn't have enough data to look at the issue. Did they ask for the data? No. In 1986, November 1986, in an effort to keep this issue alive, GCI filed an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And then we filed proposed regs. We've had hearings. We've had more hearings. We've had comments. We've had reply comments. We all have spent a lot of money on this issue. In frustration, GCI went to Senator Steve Frank and Representative Lauren Lehman and asked them if they would be interested in sponsoring a bill. They did so. The bills have not moved a lot in the last year, and last summer, GCI proposed an initiative. Alaskan proposed a counter-initiative, which they said was competition. I think that's arguable, but the point from these petitions is that almost 100,000 Alaskan voters signed petitions that they believed called for in-state competition. It's time to do something. Alaskan's earning 35% rate of return. We don't have competition still today. The APUC has put out, is noticing proposed regulations that is their version of competition. These regulations would provide for competition in the urban areas, but would prohibit competition in the rural areas. I think if Alaskan's earning a 35% rate of return, not only are the urban areas suffering, but so are the rural areas. Indeed, the entire state of Alaska is paying far too much. It's time for a change. It's time for competition now. It is not time to put this back in front of the APUC, either through legislation or by the people. It is time for competition now. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're not on teleconference on this one.
The APUC, what's their statutory requirement for their determinations over an acceptable profit rate, acceptable rate of return? Is there some action they're supposed to take when they find after the fact that someone's exceeded the 11%? Or is it up to them prior to in the rate-setting process to make a determination that it won't exceed the 11%?
During the rate-setting process, the APUC is charged with the obligation to look at a monopolist cost and then set their rates with a rate of return that will earn them a fair profit. They've set that rate of return at 11%. Yes, they do have an obligation to ensure that Alaskan or any other monopolist does not earn over that rate of return. The problem at this point, and it's clear from the recent filings that Alaskan has been substantially over-earning all along, is that it's illegal to engage in retroactive rate-making. Those profits belong to Alaskan. The only thing they can do at this point is to make the rates interim and refundable and initiate another rate case. And once the rates are made interim and refundable, from that point on, they may be refunded. But Alaskan's rates up until this time have been permanent rates, and it is my understanding that there is no refund mechanism that can be put in place at this point.
Thank you. It's your legislation.
She did an excellent job.
No, that's right.
Yeah, well,
that's right. And you should quit while you're ahead.
You can make the motion to move ahead.
Not enough paper here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry that I wasn't here to introduce the legislation. I didn't plan in the time that we have to go through it in detail, and you're probably relieved about that. And I won't tell war stories today. But I would like to note a couple things. One is I support competition in telecommunications, and you've made the statement, Mr. Chairman, several times that everybody does, including yourself. And I want to just share some information from the legislative questionnaire response that I'm getting from my district, District 9, and also some spillover from other districts. We've had about 1,800 responses to our legislative questionnaire, slightly over 1,200 from District 9, the rest mostly from other districts in Anchorage. We just asked the question, do you support a change in current law so competition for in-state long-distance service is allowed. Yes, 79%. No, 11%.
May I ask you a question? What did you expect the answer to that be? It's like, say, hey, do you like ice cream?
Right.
What kind of poll are you going to get? Now, that's one of the things, if I may inject, there's too much simplification in this thing. I think that when you made, you decided to solve this thing in the political arena. I mean, when you moved toward putting it on the ballot, I think it's the greatest disservice that's been done to the public. Or I said, do you support competition? What do you expect the public to say? Now we don't support competition? Well, certainly they're going to. And what you've done is oversimplify a very complicated issue. But anyhow, go ahead.
Well, just to put in the bigger perspective, if I was a company trying to change the status quo and I hadn't succeeded in front of the administrative agency, in front of the legislature, I'd do the same thing. You know, initiatives haven't been used so much here, so we think of them as sort of a new thing. But you know what's happened in California? The ballot's full of them. I mean, it's become the way of resolving...
Look at California.
I'm not...
I mean, hey, if you're not a fruit, you're a nut.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have some relatives there.
Come on, so don't I get tired of listening how they do it in California. This isn't California.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman,
they don't have rural villages like we do. I mean,
I'm just arguing.
I'm concerned those people are going to fall through the communication safety net out there, and nobody's convinced me yet that with all of these arguments that that's being taken care of.
Mr. Chairman, may I start?
Yeah, excuse me. I'm being very impolite here. My apologies. He was testifying. I interrupted him. But I always, my flag runs up when I see the simplification that polls. So, you know, we're politicians is what we are instead of politicians. What's the latest poll? Tell me whether to go to the bathroom or not. And so I give no validity to them. Even one that says I'm ahead in front of the mayor's race in Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with your last one. I certainly
go ahead and finish your poll, and my apologies.
Okay. But my comment was not to suggest that let's see what the people are saying and then let's just give them a simple answer. I'm not suggesting that it's simple, yes or no, but I think it's a lot simpler than we would be led to believe, and there's just a lot of public support out there for it. And I think that, therefore, we as a legislature ought to take some positive steps to implement something that takes care of those people that don't, so they won't fall through the safety net, and also so we implement a meaningful competition model. And, you know, with that, I think competition is good, and, you know, your comment and somebody else's earlier about we shouldn't be taking up in the legislature. I've seen right here in this legislature, and you've sat in the same committee with me, when people have been unsuccessful in getting certain awards and arbitrators ruled against them, they come to the legislature, try to get it turned around politically. So it's not a new, it's nothing new. And in this case, with such broad public support, I think it's the proper issue to be debating in this body.
May I give you an example? The marijuana issue, we went to loggerheads. Now the approach here is don't do anything in the legislature, solve it at the poll. So why should that be any different with this other situation, huh? Answer that.
Well,
the parallel that I'm talking about?
I'd like to tackle the issue. I'd like to tackle the other issue. I think that it's inappropriate to keep these bills from being heard and to keep them from coming to the floor. I think the proper forum is in the legislature, and we shouldn't be using the legislative process to thwart the will of the people. But, you know, we're now at day, 65 of a, or whatever, close to that, of a 121-day session on an issue like this. We're running out of time, and, you know, on an issue this big.
Well, we got more stuff in here. If half of the legislation that went in these committees, that somebody just didn't say, I introduced legislation. I for one, think there should be no more than 5 pieces of legislation introduced by each legislator during the session. There's a bunch of junk out there, and it requires a Roto-Rooter to go through and find out what's good and what's bad. So yours may be top priority. There's been a lot of work done on Frank's upstairs, and frankly, we've had staff attending every single meeting, and I don't see any closer to the solution. It's a loggerhead. It's two totally different philosophies. In other words, this doesn't say deregulate everything. Right, Dana? Let Alaskan go free, unregulated, correct?
Are you asking me if that's what you prefer?
Right.
No, that's not...
Hell no, it isn't. You want one person running with one leg and the other running with two. Deregulate the entire thing. Let's talk about true deregulation.
Mr. Chair, the reason I don't prefer that is because I don't believe that is what's best for Alaska. But if the legislature chose to deregulate the entire market, I think it would be better than what we have today.
I would be willing to accept that.
I haven't heard anybody talk about this.
Well, the bill right now is not written that way because it's written around what is the norm in other parts of the country rather than
once again, this isn't other parts of the country. Nobody has sleep mutes or barrows or that live in isolation with no roads to them, even the most isolated place. And telecommunications are lifeblood up here. And it's an issue that maybe we need more debate, but I haven't heard anybody say, let's deregulate the entire thing. In other words, we're posturing. The reason this legislation is still here, and I've been seeing it for 6 years, is because we've got lawyers posturing ever since Judge Green made his divestiture. This is a complicated issue that simple words don't lend itself to. And I candidly have not seen enough debate. I've seen an either-or situation throughout it.
Chairman, if I may.
I'll be glad. You don't have very many people here. I'll be glad to hold another hearing on this. I'm not going to move a piece of legislation out just because you think it's good. I don't think it's going to solve anything. And to come out there on the floor, a highly technical piece of legislation like this is to do the rest of the body a disservice. You and I may know something about it. But it'll get down to the simplified words of, are you for competition, push the green button. If you're not, push the stop button. And that's baloney. I mean, it's too much of that stuff that goes on. Go ahead, Daniel.
I'm not quite sure how to respond.
Well, just how you feel.
I'm not a lawyer. I believe that this issue is not that complicated. I believe that it's in Alaska's best interest to make it appear very complicated. I believe that Alaska has market power, and if it chose to try to kill us with its market power, it could, and then where would you be? You certainly would be without competition, and I don't believe that that is what's best for Alaska. Alaska is just like the lower 48 in that when you have a company that has market power, which is the ability to hold prices above or below cost for substantial periods of time, then they need to be regulated. The telecommunications industry began to be regulated because there was only one company in the industry after AT&T ran everybody else out. And for that reason, they began to regulate telecommunications through technology, and it applies in Alaska just as it applies everywhere else. There's now room for more than one company, and you should no longer keep those companies out. The question should not be, show us what competition can do for us, but show us why we shouldn't have competition. Competition is the norm, the economic norm of this nation. There's no good reason that has been put forward that I know of not to have competition in Alaska. And if you believe that this issue, with all respect, has been oversimplified, I'd like to answer your hard questions. I'd like to talk to you about rural rates. I'd like to talk to you about provisions GCI has made in its initiative to keep down rural rates that Alaska has not made in its initiative. Alaska has made the threat that if competition were allowed today, they're going to raise rural rates. And the APUC buys into that threat. The APUC buys into the threat that Alaska is going to use its monopoly power against the very people that do not have a choice. Alaska's no different. Alaska needs competition. Technology has enabled competition. GCI has come up with a way to serve the entire state of Alaska for less cost than Alaska. I don't understand any way possible that rural rates could go up unless it was a strictly punitive measure on the part of Alaska. And I believe that the APUC ought to be empowered to stop that type of action. And again, I'd like to answer your hard questions.
That's a good answer, Dana. And I like people that come out and say just like, that's probably the best testimony you've given.
And I didn't even
I'm tired of clipboard answers here. I mean, this should be more a debate, a more free-flowing discussion. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it again next week.
Okay.
But don't just come here and say you should move this to the floor for a vote. Come on.
I didn't say that, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you did.
Well, I was jesting with you.
Okay.
I didn't come in here expecting that you would. I'd be delighted if you would, but I realize that you have an interest in this and you want to hear debate.
There isn't enough. What I have actually done is deferred to the Senate side. Because there appeared to be a clear issue, and from the political end of the spectrum, maybe next year you'll be on the other side, there was a majority member over on the Senate doing something. If there was any opportunity to move legislation, it would have been there. And if they had come to a solution, we would have probably adopted it on this side. So far, they're not. I see no more than the same old button heads. What that been happening up there, they're catching up to speed with what I've been listening to for 6 years down here. And I still don't hear that note that says, you know, there might be a point here. There might be a compromise. But as you know, I admire your straightforwardness. You're probably the best thing that GCI has got going for us, and especially when you're there talking, and you don't need to be a lawyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
But I will, probably you were surprised I even scheduled it, weren't you? Okay, well, Donna, you can talk to Dennis, and we'll give you an opportunity next week to do a full court press on the thing, and I'm going to give Alaskan the same opportunity to do it.
Mr. Chairman, do we have a few minutes to try to squeeze in some testimony from the Department of Revenue on this other bill? They three people that waited quite a while.
And you can teleconference, although I'd like to see you down here, but we will schedule it for sometime next week.
Thank you very much.
Or we can simply carry it over, right, Dennis? Just find out which day are convenient for them in Alaska.
Wonderful.
All right, we got... Now, go ahead on your legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't say much. The department has waited here a long time. I was hoping they've given us some very extensive material.
You go right ahead.
And I was hoping we could just call them up and let them make a brief presentation. They have a very in-depth fiscal note on the bill. And I thought it would best serve our time to have them come forward. I can summarize it. I like the bill, they don't. I think that's a good summary.
Okay. All right. David, go ahead. Can you summarize it? You like the bill, they don't.
Yeah, I was hoping that they could testify since we have so little time left.
Okay, we're passionate, but we will go ahead and take that. We can all be a minute or two late, and then we can put this on our full calendar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It'll be coming up next week.
For the record, my name is Urban Jones. I'm the director of the Firm Fund Dividend Division, Department of Revenue. You know, I guess and I will try to be brief. I understand that it's already run over. I guess Representative Finkelstein is correct in saying that the department's not real crazy about the bill. We do think that the two-year return rule is a good law that was passed a couple years ago. We've seen from firsthand experience that it does work. It's a manageable law, and it has worked in the sense that what we've seen over the last year, the first year that it was implemented was 1989, what we've seen is that there are approximately 8,000 people who we believe would have filed and received dividends had that law not been on the books, either chose not to file because it had not been back to the States since sometime before July of 1987, or if they did file, they have been or will be denied for the same reason. During that period of time, we've heard from several hundred people who have indicated to the department for various reasons that it would be unreasonable, impractical, or would create a financial strain on their families if they were to come back to the state. And generally, the way their argument runs is that, and keeping in mind that we're talking about their home state, that it's not worth their money to fly back to the state from wherever it is that they live now to get a dividend. And when we explain to them that we're not talking about one dividend, we're talking about two dividends, they hem-haw a little bit, and we explain to them that if they come back in late June and stay till early July, that that one visit will qualify their family for 3 years worth of dividends, they hesitate even more. But from our point of view, it has worked because there are still several thousand people outside the state who do come back. And I believe from the conversations I've had with, as I mentioned, several hundreds of these people, what's happened is that the people who really believe that this is their home state largely do return, and they would have with or without the law. The people who have paper ties to this state for one of several reasons, the dividend being one, and the fact that we have no income tax being another, have not come back to the state, and I believe they would not have come back to the state whether or not the law had been on the books. The difference is whether they received a dividend or not. The difficult part about the legislation from our point of view in terms of implementing it is that it calls upon the department to test the practicality of an individual coming back. That is a test that just doesn't lend itself any kind of standards. You know, what is practical for one person is not practical for another person. In any event, it gets us into a situation where we will be reviewing thousands of applications, each having a unique set of family problems, job problems, transportation problems, or financial problems, and that's the one that we hear the most about. Each one of those will have to be weighed as a unique situation. The decisions will probably be perceived by the member of the public as being arbitrary, and probably fairly so, because it is a very judgmental question that we're being asked to decide. Our experience has been over the last 8 years that where an applicant believes that the decision by the department is arbitrary, that it was a discretionary decision, that the legislature had granted that discretion to an employee of the state, they tend to appeal as long as it doesn't cost them any money. And there are two levels to that appeal process, one in the division, which is the informal conference, and then they have the right to a formal hearing before a hearing officer, the commissioner, taking the place of a much more expensive APA hearing. If they are still unsatisfied, of course, they can go to Superior Court at that point. What we've seen is that when there's been a debate, if you will, in an informal process and in the review process as to the merits of their claim to residency, the percentages of people that appeal are relatively low when they're denied. But if it's something that's discretionary, where they think if they can talk to somebody higher up in the chain that they'll see it differently and they'll get paid, they tend to appeal almost 100%. So what we would expect in this case is that about 90% of the people that we deny will appeal all the way to formal hearing. And those are the two factors that drive the fiscal note. We're not real happy about coming in here with $1.5 million in the fiscal impact, but it is a, and as Commissioner Malone's letter indicates, he refers to it as blue sky. I don't think I would characterize it quite that strongly, but it is a difficult thing to do a fiscal note on, but I think this is a pretty accurate picture of the magnitude of the problem. I mean, we might be off by a couple $100,000, but it's a big problem for us. We like the law the way it is, and you know, we'd like to see it stay that way. It does work. Thank you.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express my appreciation to the department for, you know, making such an effort to try to analyze the bill's effects, and I think you made some good points.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify?
I was planning on testifying. I don't know if you want more information. I was planning on addressing the proposed legislation from the hearing officer perspective.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we may need to go to the floor.
All right. Well, why don't we, a couple of minutes, would that be adequate?
Certainly adequate for me.
All right, go ahead then, just so you don't have to come over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Deborah Bode, and I am the Senior Hearing Officer for the Department of Revenue. I oversee the hearing section within the Commissioner's Office. We do formal hearings that coming from four divisions, the Oil and Gas Audit Division, Income and Excise Audit Division, Child Support Enforcement, and the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Currently, my section reviews approximately 300 cases coming from the PFD section. Those may contain a lot more applications than 300 because we treat a family group as one application. I agree with Mr. Jones that substantially all of the people who have not returned within 2 years would assert that they had, that it was impractical for them to do so, and I agree with Mr. Jones's analysis that those people will continue to appeal, considering that the next person up will listen more sympathetically to their story. The point I wanted to make is that impracticality is in the eye of the beholder, and I think that that leads to, first, an arbitrary system, and second, to a system that is not good government. From the administration perspective, I have thought for the last couple of days of what kind of standards I'd like to set for the hearing section to apply this kind of law, and I can't think of any. I think that the intent of the legislation is that unusual circumstances, unforeseen circumstances, and so on may prevent an applicant from returning. I think you can't regulate in that kind of an area just precisely because circumstances are unusual and varying. And I think that the result is that you would have a system of completely arbitrary decision-making. It would depend on the worldview of the hearing officer, the worldview of the commissioner, and the mood of those people on the day that the person told their story in front of those people. I think from a public policy perspective, it's always been my view that this kind of a slippery slope discretionary standard is bad law, in that it does not give the public a true understanding of what the requirements of the program are. And it basically, in my view, benefits those people who know how to work the system. If you have two people in identical circumstances, one of whom is educated, articulate, knows his representatives, and so on, that person is likely to get relief. The person in identical circumstances, without education, without a sort of familiarity of how to work the system, is going to be denied. And I don't think that's good government. It's really the basis of my remarks.
Thank you, Deborah. You never find a new byword slipping in. Slippery slope.
I don't think that's new.
Right. I like that. Hey, that's a slippery slope.
The courts know slippery slopes.
What?
The courts know slippery slopes when they see
them. Yeah, right. You got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We will carry these two pieces of legislation over. And with that, the meeting is adjourned so we can get to